Real pleasure to introduce Tracy, who some people know as Tracy Curl, but she's in fact Tracy Walker. So she's two people at once, so we get more than our money's worth. Name that tune.
Yeah, apparently Charles called me Tracy Curl earlier, and I didn't even notice, so I don't mind either one. Thanks very much for inviting me to come to this. It was quite a shock to get the reminder after having agreed to come back in June, but it was a pleasant surprise, I can say that. One of the joys of giving an invited talk is that you can sort of choose what it is that you're going to talk about in a, I think, for me anyway, a freer way than sometimes when you have to submit an abstract and those kind of things. So my talk is not going to be today a primarily research-based talk, though I am going to sort of do a whistle-stop tour through some of my research and a little summary of the latest thing that I've been working on with Trevor Benjamin. But for those of you that were here at this event last year, I know Trevor presented that work here, so he kind of scooped me on that. Yeah. And so I wasn't able to talk to you about that primarily. So what I am going to be doing is kind of a, it's not, I hope anyway, it's not planned to be as strident, let's say, as maybe a position paper. But what has sort of got me is, in the review of the paper that is coming out in Discourse Processes, one of the reviewers asked us to more clearly separate the form of the practice we were talking about from its function. And that got me thinking, because I like to think that I'm pretty good at that. And I like to ask other people to do that. So to get it back in my own review, I thought, wow, okay, I need to really focus on this. This is, because to me, as a someone who's trained as a linguist doing CA, that this is a very important topic for me. So I thought, I will give this issue some thought and develop this paper that I'm going to talk to you about today. And again, this is an. I think this should be an issue for all of us, not just for me, because I'm trained as a linguist, I work in the linguistics department, I want to talk to linguists, I want to talk to people outside the parish, as Charles referred to it earlier. I want to be able to talk to more than just people who think in exactly the same ways that I do. And I want to be able to engage with other approaches, and to be able to do so in a way that I have confidence is scientifically grounded, if I can use that word. So as we go through this talk, please don't go away with the impression that one of the things I want to happen is that we multiply the jargon, for lack of a better term, that we use, but rather to try to eliminate some of it. Okay? So now I'll finally get off my first slide. So some of my assumptions, and assumptions that I'm pretty sure I share with everyone in this audience, are these type of things, that any utterance in a conversation is doing more than one thing at a time. And maybe most importantly, that meaning is co-constructed and emergent, and all aspects of the design of a term, you don't have to have linguistic design there if you don't want to think of it that way. And also, as I was looking over my slides, I thought, ooh, I mean more than linguistic design, don't I? I also mean the gesture, anything visible that you can see. So all aspects of design contribute to the potential action that could be performed by any utterance. So let's take it as a given that we all believe these things to be true. If then, I think there is a tendency in our published work, and including myself very much in this, it's not a diatribe, to support the idea that some intonation contours have a meaning no matter where they are, and that they just mean that thing, and you just put it on top of whatever it is you're saying, and then that whatever you're saying means that thing that the intonation means. Okay? Now, I'm sure a lot of you are thinking, well, I would never do that. My work doesn't do that. And I think my work doesn't do that as well, as you can see from this quote. All of the quotes that I use in here, whether positively or negatively, I have put in the references on your handout, because most of them, even if I pick at something that they have said, I do think the paper as a whole is quite good. So we'll, I don't mean this about mine. We'll see some other people's as well. So in this paper that I wrote with Gareth Walker and John Local, we said that glossing utterances or actions with vernacular terms such as polite or rude or angry or bored, etc., is not a useful analysis unless it can, one, show whether the participants displayed the observable orientation, right, to those categories, or also, number two, to explain what it is about the organization of those utterances. And by organization, that's where I mean the linguistic design, every aspect of it. What is happening in it that makes me want to gloss it in such a way, or that makes it relevant, or that makes it, dare I say, true to gloss it in such a way, okay? So again, although when I found this score, I thought, that was really nice, who wrote that? I don't know which one of us wrote it, none of us can remember. We're like, yeah, we think that, okay? And we say this, and I think most of us here again too would say, yes, I believe in that. But I want to question whether or not we sometimes only pay that idea lip service. So first of all, what I'll do is I'll move to the way that people talk about intonation contours outside of CA, mainly in an area known to linguists as intonational phonology. Now, this is from a book, Cruttenden's book, and he's quite interested in assigning meanings to intonation contours. And because this is comes from a, I don't know if it exactly goes so far as, I don't know if it's right for me to go so far as to say a generative sort of background, but this comes from a tradition in which if you as a native speaker get that interpretation, then that's good enough. That's fine. Okay? There's no interest in observable orientation to a label. It's just that if that's what it sounds like to you, well, you're in the club, you're a native speaker of that language, you get to say that. So that's the proof in this kind of tradition. And so what Cruttenden is saying is that, for instance, if we consider what meanings that tone, whatever tone he's talking about, has, when combined with each of the sentence types, we may end up describing a number of local meanings, like weighty, impatient, dispassionate, serious, powerful. Now, for me and other the linguists and CA people who trained me, this is exactly the kind of thing that we go, ha, 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 we would never do that. We would never say, oh, yes, well, you know, this utterance sounds weighty. This person is being impatient when he says this. Or, oh, what a dispassionate thing to say, okay? Because I think of those as vernacular glosses that if you want to use those kind of words, you've got to go a lot further than just say, these are all meanings which are suggested by a low fall. Because some of those, to me, also don't go together. I don't get how serious and impatient are related. And I don't know how they, if they are both suggested by a low fall, well, does that mean that they have some kind of connection to each other? So I say poo-poo to this kind of research, right? However, this is something that's bothered me for a long time, and I don't think it will be news to lots of people. Is this the naming of other kinds of intonation contours, which I think we've all done at some point or another. I've picked out a paper by Rebecca Clift here, not because I think she's particularly guilty, but because this is the Actually paper published in Language. Okay? So this is a journal, a very, very impressive journal aimed at linguists, where we find that a period indicates a falling, okay, fine, a falling intonation contour, lovely. But then we see a falling or final intonation contour. Not necessarily the end of a sentence. A question mark indicates rising intonation. Hooray. We don't get any function there. Just a question mark indicates rising intonation. But then we continue with a comma indicates continuing intonation. Where there we get no form whatsoever, just a function. So with falling or final intonation, we get the form in falling, and then suddenly the function in final. Okay? And this is what I want to speak about today. Here's another example from a paper by Robinson and Caveau Feldman. Again, a lovely paper about using full repeats to initiate repair on others' questions. And again, I just want to point out that here's another example of conflating a form, turn final level intonation, with the function, continuing We can't project the lack of term completion. So in a sense, we're getting a mix-up of the forms and the function, and the input to the analysis and the outcome of the analysis are not that easy to disentangle when you talk about them like this. Now, one place where I think all of us are quite good at separating form and function, and we maybe because you can see it more easily, is when we are talking about actions.
Okay.
I'm going to use examples from my research here, but if I had sort of been more inclined and not felt like I was just ripping off from other people and invited to give an invited talk, I could have used research, I'm sure, from any published papers in CA to talk about the separation of form and function when we talk about actions. Okay, because one of the things that we do when we do this kind of analysis is we talk about how forms accomplish particular actions. We don't just say that every time you find every time you find a modal verb like could or couldn't or should or something like that, you don't say, "Oh, right, well, I've seen that, so now I know that that's a request." So the point I'm trying to make here is that we wouldn't go around calling things like could or I wonder if requesting grammar, but we do say things like final intonation or continuing intonation. And I want to point out that that's the same type of idea. Another example of how it's important to separate form and function, and also leading into why it can be so difficult to do so, is to look at some of my work from the repetition repair work from ages ago now. But what that work shows is that if you collect a huge set of repetition repairs, so are you in the bathroom? What? You in the bathroom? Okay. Then you end up with, and you compare the second saying of you in the bathroom to the first saying of you in the bathroom, the kind of phonetic changes that you find in the second saying are not all the same. I thought they would be. But the first set, one set you get, sound like this. So listen to the second time it's said compared to the first time. I don't know how loud it's going to be, so it's going to be a bit short.
What did you do? You sing not to the pause? I'm sorry, I couldn't get any more.
Okay, so that was from the first set where you heard things like the expanded pitch range, the fact that the second saying was louder, it took longer to say, there were altered vocal track settings over a long domain, okay? And I said, right, okay, well, all of these things are occurring together. I'm going to call that an upgraded phonetic pattern because things are looking up. It's a bit more of everything. Now, there were also a set of repetitions that sounded like this. So again, listen to the second time it said in relation to the first.
You in the bathroom? You in the bathroom?
Is he dating at all? Is he dating at all?
He lives there.
Do you get to see Robin Lott? Do you get to see Robin Lott?
So these had a compressed pitch range. They're quieter, they're shorter, and in articulatory terms, the second saying is very, very similar to the first. Okay, so there's a different set of phonetic events going on with these repetitions than we heard in the first group. And I called these non-upgraded phonetic pattern. I didn't call them downgraded because that just didn't seem appropriate. Non-upgraded worked a lot better because the compression in the pitch range is very small, they're only a little bit quieter. It just didn't seem to me like a lot of work was being done, even phonetically, to make them less than the first saying. They were just pretty much the same, or not more than the first saying. So, hence the term non-upgraded. A bit dull, I'll grant you, but correct. Okay. Now, obviously, that wasn't very interesting in and of itself. And those two things, these descriptions, again, give us the form. So we had these, I found that there were these two different phonetic forms, which wasn't the answer I was aiming at, but that was what was there. So then I was left with the problem of, well, why? If you're lexically repeating the thing you just said after the other initiation of repair, so the sequence looks the same, right? X, what, X. Y, what, Y. Why is sometimes the second one different from the first one? And why is it different in different ways? Okay? Why are there two forms for these kind of repetitions? So I went looking for the function that this kind of thing could possibly be doing. And by looking back through the data, back further into the, back, you know, reversing through the interaction, I found that the class of upgraded repetition repairs tended to follow trouble source turns, so the first saying, that were basically fitted to where they belonged, or to where they occurred, okay? They were appropriately, the first time it was said, before the repair was initiated, it made sense there. It was appropriately fitted, way had been paved for this thing to happen, okay? They either continued what was going on before, or they were the initiation of a new sequence, but once the previous thing had been closed, collaboratively couldn't see any particular problems there, okay? Now the non-upgraded ones, occurred after trouble source turns that were disjunct. They didn't make sense in the sequence where they occurred, and they weren't appropriately introduced as disjunct. They just aren't relevant next actions, the trouble source turns aren't, when they occur, okay? They don't make an obvious link to the prior turn. They don't do intersubjectivity. They aren't displaying a shared understanding of what's going on in the interaction to that point, okay? So then I had a handle on the function of the two different types of what was going on, okay? Now, this is where I want to say that this is why this is not a diatribe in any way, and also to give some explanation for why I chose the word non-upgraded instead of downgraded. Here, in this work of my own, as a human being, I want to make the conceptual link between the form and the function and say, see, upgraded phonetics is doing an upgraded function. Upgraded form equals upgraded function, it's iconic, ta-da. Anyone would know that. You don't need to do a lot of analysis for that. That's clear, it's there, okay? But the thing is, it is actually the outcome of a lot of analysis. But I think, and I'm going a bit out on a limb here, is I think that's just the way our brain wants to work. It wants there to be form-function correlations. It would have been much harder for me to conceptualize this work if the things I was calling upgraded phonetics had been the ones that occurred after disjunct trouble source turns, wouldn't it? I bet I would have called the phonetics something else. I bet I wouldn't have called it upgraded, okay? So you can see that the latest version of this, I think, was published in 2005. So for 7 years, I've been worrying about calling, oh, I have, it's pathetic, I know. But then I called those upgraded, because God, everyone's gonna think then that I mean every time this kind of thing happens with the phonetics that there's an upgraded function going along with that, okay? And that's not what I meant. And I think that in this case, it's just in some ways an accident that there is this iconic match between an upgrade in phonetics and an upgrade in function, claiming you were wrong to do that NTRI, I was right to say that where I did, so here it is again with a bit more behind it. Okay? So it happens, right? These things happen together. But I think we should work when we can to make sure that we are decoupling form and function to strengthen our analyses. In the case of turn taking, and the turn, the final intonation and the continuing intonation, Local and Walker 2012 has just come out. It's not me, Walker, it's the other one. it's not me. In Journal of the International Phonetics Association, a journal which most of you are probably not likely to pick up and have a browse through. But I can highly recommend this paper. Again, it's on your handout. Because what, I can't continue calling them Local and Walker, I'll have to call them Gareth and John. And I'm not trying to name drop, it's just awkward. What Gareth and John have finally done is they have looked through the how phonetic features are actually being used to project more talk, okay? And of course, the flip side of that is also how are phonetic features not being used to project more talk and thus to project the end of a turn is coming, okay? So what they found is that as much as we all think it's the intonation that we're relying on, and again, as a human being, that's what I think. Okay? I always separate being a human being from being an analyst, and my students find that quite amusing, but I think there has to be some separation there. So when I talk about being a human being, that's what I mean. What John and Gareth have found is that when you have, they took one entire conversation, the whole thing, out of the field data, and they marked out all of the places of possible syntactic completion. Okay, and at each, and for the everyone's turn, both turns, everybody's turns, and at every point of possible syntactic completion, they went through and did a whole slew of acoustic and impressionistic phonetic measurements and recordings. Okay. So they were checking things like amount of reduction, amount of assimilation, the pitch, where was the pitch, what's the timing like, okay? And probably many more things that I'm forgetting to mention. Okay? So they weren't privileging looking at the intonation. They wanted to know what is the whole phonetic gestalt, if you will, of what's going on at each of these places of possible syntactic completion. And what they found is this. If you reach a potential point of syntactic completion, and in their 13 cases where at that point there was a fall to low pitch, but that was the only thing that went along with saying my turn is complete, okay? So if it only three of those resulted in turn transition. In the cases where, in 67 cases where the fall to low pitch co-occurred with other markers of turn completion, and those were things like aspiration of final voiceless consonants, final audible out-breaths, okay? When those occurred all together, yes, then you do get turn transition. But just doing a fall to low isn't gonna get you the finalness of it. And why I said that they've finally done this work at the beginning of talking about this slide was that now it's all there and we can all cite it and we don't have to talk about final intonation anymore, okay? Yay. And so that's my question is that we should think about what do we mean when we're saying final intonation? Do you need to say it that way in your analysis for some particular reason, okay? Or is it just a very attractive and easy to use and easy to understand for most of us conflation of form and function? So basically what I'm arguing for is that we should use descriptively accurate labels for phonetic design. So this paper that Trevor and I have just finished talks about high-rise falls, okay? And that's not very catchy, but I think it's better than this alternative, claiming problems of veracity, more contextual appropriateness falls, or even saying something like questioning acceptability intonation. Because to me, if you can say something like continuing intonation, then you should also be able to talk about questioning acceptability intonations. Because if that's what's helping you question the acceptability, then just stick it on there as an adjective. Don't. happens. Don't do that. I'm saying don't do. Okay? So, yeah. So here is an example of our high-rise fall that we did not call climbing acceptability with veracity or moral intentional appropriateness. And again, just another plug for my own research, because this is available online in discourse processes now. If you heard it last year, you can now read it. And this transcript, this is on your handout, finally, as number one. And so our argument here was that what you see in the shading in line five is A, suggesting that James Cameron was the director of a particular film, and then B initiates repair on this with James Cameron, which you can hear here.
James Cameron. James Cameron.
Okay. So that's B in line seven. And then they go on to have a bit of an argument about that. Okay? And we another one is here in Utah, given in number two.
Utah.
Okay. So A says he got a job in Utah, right? And then B comes in with
Utah. Utah.
Okay. And so what we found was that using this kind of an intonation contour, and I did, in fact, check loads of other things. I was sure there was a regularity in the timing of these things relative to the other person saying it the first time. Couldn't find a pattern. I'm still looking, because I think it's there, but I can't pin it down. So I looked at the other phonetic parameters, I couldn't find anything. It does seem to me to be the intonation that is doing this thing of marking this out as a problem with acceptability. Now, one of the things that had been suggested to us, because they sound like this.
James Cameron. James Cameron.
Okay. Is that, well, isn't that just surprise? And I went, eek! Well, no, it's not just surprise. And that's one reason why I gave you the transcripts here, is that I don't think glossing the turns in line 7 and line 6 on the first two examples as surprise does us any good. It doesn't capture what it's really there for. And I don't want it to tell me anything about what it really sounds like. This is a visual representation of what it sounds like. If you must have a representation, have something like this. Don't have another word, okay? Because for one reason to do that is that you need surprise to do other things. In the third example on your handout, guess who called here last night looking for your address? Who? Aiden Hendricks. Not really what they're going to say.
Adam Holmack. Adam Holmack.
Okay. And then as you can see from your transcript, Bill, who is actually Jen's father, goes on to laugh, and then she says, why? Well, Mommy and I were seated with his mother. I'm sure this is why. Okay. This does not follow the same trajectory as the other ones. Okay. Yeah. That contour looks very, very similar. I'm not disputing that at all. What I'm saying is, just because you have a high-rise falling contour, it may or may not be doing surprise. Sometimes it's doing surprise, sometimes it isn't. In our collection of them, sometimes it wasn't, and those were the ones that we wanted to talk about in that paper. The other reason is that your surprise may not be my surprise. This has bothered me for a long time, and as a non-native speaker of English, as it is often pointed out to me in York, I don't know if my feeling of the emotion that is being expressed by something is the same as what happened for the speakers or even the other people I'm trying to address when I write. So I dug out the old Rogers. And there are some of the other meanings or other words you can use as synonyms for surprise. I wouldn't have really thought bewilder and surprise were that close in meaning, but maybe for some people they are. So let's not have any more bewildering intonations. Thank you.
Thank you. discussion and argument.
I'd like to talk very much. I've had a lot of debates with a colleague of mine who is a lab phenologist who studies these emissions. So he definitely has this idea that there is one abstract meaning, and his goal is to find it. He agrees that it's very difficult, so he doesn't jump to intuitive characterizations. But my question concerns something that you said. So you said at one point that iconicity is maybe an accident. I thought that's kind of interesting. But what is your opinion on one of the most, maybe the most famous observations about iconicity and intonation, which is the so-called frequency code for sort of rising, going up, for questioning and falling, going down, for asserting. So do you think that there's any evidence that something like that is real, or is this just an analyst's dream?
So you're not talking about the biological frequency code, like for gender, are you? You're asking about the thing about the questions and all
well,
that.
Well, I think that's
I
one
think they're related. Yeah. In regards to what you said about the questions, yeah, and about me saying iconicity was an accident, that is kind of an interesting way to put it. I'm interested that I put it that way. I think. And this is something of an answer that I've stolen a bit from Richard Ogden, who brought it up. I think it was a talk that Bill actually was giving at York, Bill Wells was giving at York. And people were talking about, you know, the meanings of intonation contours. Some people in my department are firm believers in that as well. And one of the things Richard pointed out was, given that most of us here as well are interested in the use of language as in societies with people as social animals. How much of it, what if it's the other way around? What if it's not that, you know, questions bring frequency rises, but that frequency rises were just happening and people heard them and they thought, okay, yeah, we'll keep those associated with questions. And we'll keep the other things associated with non-questions. So do you see what I mean? What if it's not a matter of, what if it is just an accident? What if it, you know, if we all started out in the same, if we're all human beings sharing the same kind of communicative architecture, desire, sociality, need for that, we have to have things that all work out together. And maybe that's, I am totally riffing here. Maybe that's just one of the most basic things that we, as humans, as that species ever learned, and it's just stuck with us.
But I think that the frequency code is kind of that kind of argument, right? Mm-hmm. That there is something in nature or something in biology that associates high pitches with certain types of things and low pitches with other types of things. Mm-hmm. And so then, is what you're saying distinct from that? Because that is a kind of iconic type argument that then puts it back into sort of nature or sort of the patterns that we observe that we don't understand where they even came from.
Yeah. I guess I don't want to say that there isn't any element of iconicity in language at all, because I think that would go way too far. But I think that what makes a language is the fact that you don't have to stick to that. You can have completely arbitrary relationships between the signifier and the sign. You don't have to. There may be elements of that that remain, and I think, as I said about the stuff that I've done, that seems to fit. That I can't get away from that making sense. So I think that I would like to be much more against that idea, but I think that in some ways it makes sense. But I don't like to see it applied, you know, as a blanket for everything. It's not the answer to everything. Best I can do.
Anna Lindstrom.
I thought it was interesting you pulled out that quote from Rebecca Cliff, because I think it seems to me that quote, I recognize it from
the
other
papers. It's not her. Yeah, I didn't mean in any way to, that's what I meant.
Yeah,
I didn't mean in any way to say it was like Rebecca made this up. That's what everyone puts when they're explaining their transcription.
But there's an interesting thing about that, because those of us who work on other languages than English, and there are increasing number of us, I've actually always taken out that continuing, because I thought, well, maybe for English there's research to support that, but I want to leave it open.
Right.
For my language, so it might be an interesting thing to look at how that is described in papers that are not working in English, because I know I've always sort of taken that out.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that John and Gareth were looking for, is actually what are the phonetic events that go around with keeping going, keeping your turn going, rather than it signaling the end of it. Because I think for them, that's one of the more interesting things, is how do you keep going when you reach these points of syntactic completion? And somebody could have come in, but people don't. There are loads of places where, you know, if you take that approach to turn construction, well, you could have come here, but you don't, and here you do.
Mm-hmm.
And they were interested in looking at all those points where you don't. And it was because, their explanation is, it's because actually there are loads of phonetic cues telling the interlocutor, you don't come here, okay, now you could.
Bill Wells.
Yeah, there's just a couple of points, really. One was about the iconicity.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a whole bunch of English accents that do rise in pitch, as we know, for declaratives.
Mm-hmm.
Probably do falling pitch or low. So it just doesn't stack up on an empirical basis to make the claim that there is some kind of inevitability about it. And maybe there's a kind of unmarkedness about it, which is a slightly different argument. I was just wondering if you could now hereby abandon the full stop, comma, and question mark in transcripts, or would you be happy to say that we can use a full stop as equivalent of a fall, and a question mark as equivalent of a high rise, and the other thing, a comma as
a
level?
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that what people want to do, or can we just leave them out?
I think most people who know me, and you may have seen in these transcripts, I haven't used punctuation of that sort in years in transcripts, because I haven't found it particularly necessary or helpful. Partly that's because I have some slightly more specialist training, where if I need to talk about particular local phonetic events, I can do that in, you know, woo fancy ways. But I would like to see them abandoned, because also, why would you only put them some places and not other places? And then because you've also got arrows, and you've got double arrows, and I don't think that we need them so much. I prefer to see sort of other systems where you try and divide turns by line, or TCU division, or something like that, and maybe put I think this isn't the place to introduce the difference between a working transcript and a presentation transcript, but that's another thing to think about, is when you develop a transcript that you want to put in your publication, that needs to show what it needs to show, which is what is on here. And this isn't the kind of transcript I would work with, you know, with the shading and the boxes and the caret and the capital letters. That's all just to say, hey, guess what, everybody? This is what we're talking about, and this is an iconic way of putting it on paper for you. I'm obviously, this is a bit of a loaded question, because Bill knows that I don't use that kind of punctuation in my transcripts, and I'm not at all sure. I would be interested in hearing from people who think that it is necessary and that we do need to keep using it.
All we need is journals to have embeddable sound clips.
Well,
transcript is not detailed enough.
Oh, right.
So what is, if you take them out, you get, well, what's the punctuation like, what's the intonation like, so what's your proposal?
No, that's very interesting. I had no idea that that people would make comments like the transcript isn't detailed enough. I guess I've been very lucky in that regard. If that is, my response to that, if someone were to question my use of that kind of thing, would simply be to say, that is not of import for this argument. Yes, I have considered it. Yes, I have looked at it. I don't need to say that here, so I haven't put it in. There are loads of other things you don't put in a transcript. Like you said, it's all subjective to some extent. And as long as you are being a careful researcher and you know you've looked at that thing and you know you've listened to it. Because another thing I think that having a more bare transcript forces you to do is to retain an oral memory of the data and also to keep going back to it. Because you can't just look at your transcript and say, oh yeah, well there's a couple of periods there, so those things must sound the same. It's not a full answer to your question, but I think any kind of system that works for you, if you know there's something you need to remember because it sounds important, right there that it sounds important, that kind of thing. What I'm not suggesting you do is that you would then necessarily try to put those symbols out there for other people to use, right? I've just never been one for what I've heard other people describe as the fetishization of the transcript. I'm just not interested in that. All I want to know is the basic sequence of what happened and then go and listen to it and find what I want from that.
Anna, another question you have.
Yeah, of course this is opening sort of Pandora's box. I think it's also a good discussion because I do think it's useful to encourage people to see talk in terms of term construction and units and implements. Mm-hmm. So one way that I see of using information markers and the capital letters is to mark that. And of course those who write in English can rely on others sort of understanding that term, but if you work on a language with a different kind of syntactic structure and a different kind of prosody, those things can be useful. I'm thinking of periods and those markers for sort of conveying how something was said, because we can't rely on people sort of hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So for me, it's not quite as easy so to just sort of walk into the market. But it's
working.
Yes.
One last quick one, Kobe.
So we've moved from intonational meaning to just like intonation altogether.
Yeah.
So do you not believe in boundary tones, then, for example? Because one idea about transcribing, a period or some kind of rise or mid-rise, or just some basic distinction at the end of the intonational unit, is that there are these kinds of intonational phenomena that occur at the end of units, and that they are relevant. We don't necessarily a priori know why or how to describe why. But so do you think that actually that the intonational phonologists do tell us that there are things like boundary tones for at the ends of all coherent intonation units? Is that also?
I think I would probably surprise you even more by saying that I'm not really sure that I'm completely enamored of the idea of an intonation unit, just sort of as an abstract unit that exists on its own. So no, I would go all the way back to the beginning and say, and I've always struggled with the idea that there's a finite set of boundary tones even that help us do whatever they do.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm much more than agnostic on that issue.
Okay.
So yeah.
Thanks. Good. Let's stop there. Another round of applause. Thank you.